The end of a year always feels like a quiet funeral. The calendar turns and we treat it like a fresh beginning. Fireworks, resolutions, promises. But something deeper is happening underneath. Every ending carries the weight of death. The death of moments you'll never relive. Of versions of yourself that can't come with you. Of people and places that have already drifted away. The truth is, the new year isn't just a celebration of what's ahead. It's the burial of what's behind. Yet most people rush to escape that truth. They rush to the next version of their life without honoring the death of the old one. Every January, people write long lists of goals, dreams, habits they'll start and bad ones they'll quit, but they rarely stop to ask, who is setting these goals? The same mind that failed to keep last year's promises? The same self that's built on comfort, fear, and old identity? You can't rebuild your life with the same tools that broke it. You can't step into a new chapter while dragging the same character into it. And that's why most change doesn't last, because people try to change their behavior without changing who they are. Philosophy has always known this. Every great thinker understood that rebirth requires death. The Stoics spoke about renewal, about letting go of the past and accepting impermanence as the rhythm of life. Nietzsche called this self-overcoming, the destruction of what is weak, false, and outdated within us so that something higher can emerge. And Carl Jung called it individuation, the process of facing your shadow, integrating your hidden truths, and becoming a whole unified self. They were all speaking about the same thing: to grow, you must die. But this death isn't physical. It's not about losing your life. It's about shedding everything false that clings to it. The opinions that shaped you, the fears that ruled you, the stories you've repeated so often that you began to believe them. This is the kind of death that frees. The kind that burns away what's artificial, so what's real can finally breathe. 2026 shouldn't be another attempt to chase more goals, more money, more distractions. It should be the year you stop adding and start subtracting. Not a list of new achievements, but a commitment to transformation. To stop running from who you've been and consciously decide who you will become. And so the real question for this year isn't what you want to achieve. It's much deeper than that. What must die in you for your next evolution to live? Transformation doesn't begin when you make a plan for change. It begins when you're finally willing to destroy the parts of yourself that keep you small, afraid, and dependent. Most people try to improve themselves by adding more habits, more routines, more motivation. But true growth isn't about addition, it's about subtraction. You don't become new by stacking new layers on top of who you already are. You become new by burning away everything that isn't truly you. This is what Nietzsche meant when he said, "I teach you the overman. Man is something that shall be overcome." The overman, or Übermensch, wasn't a perfect being. He was someone who had transcended the lies he told himself, the false morality that chained him, the parts of him that were borrowed from others. Nietzsche believed that before you can create something great, you must destroy everything false and weak within you. Creation follows destruction, the way spring follows winter. But destruction is painful, and that's why most people avoid it. The false self, the one built on ego and comfort, fights for survival. It whispers, "You're fine as you are, you don't need to change." It tells you that your habits aren't that bad, that your fears are justified, that your past defines you. It makes you defend your limitations as if they're your identity. And the moment you start questioning those lies, it resists. Because part of you knows that once you expose the truth, the old self won't survive it. And that's terrifying. We say we want change, But deep down, we want change that doesn't cost us anything. We want rebirth without death. We want the light without the fire, but the fire is what forges you. Carl Jung understood this as the battle with the shadow. The shadow is the part of you that hides everything you don't want to admit. Your envy, your fears, your lust, your anger, your selfishness. It's the side of you that society told you to repress, that parents or teachers made you feel ashamed of. But ignoring the shadow doesn't make it disappear. It only grows in the dark. Jung wrote that, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. In other words, everything you refuse to confront ends up controlling you. The temper you can't control, the jealousy that poisons your relationships, the laziness that ruins your goals. These aren't random flaws. They are your shadow in disguise acting through you because you refuse to face it directly. That's why you cannot build a new identity on denial. You can't hide your darkness and expect to be reborn into light. The repressed always returns, through failure, through addiction, through self-sabotage. It comes back every time you promise yourself, "I'll change," but never address what's underneath. Rebirth doesn't happen because you decide to change. It happens when you finally stop running from the truth, when you face yourself so honestly that it hurts. So how do you start? You begin with brutal self-examination. Sit with yourself in silence. No distractions, no excuses. Ask, what am I pretending not to see about myself? Write it down, all of it. Every addiction, every weakness, every habit that drags you back into the same version of yourself you swore you'd outgrow. Be specific. Maybe it's your need for validation, your fear of failure, your obsession with control, your tendency to blame others. Don't judge these things. Simply face them. Awareness is the beginning of transformation. When you bring darkness into light, it loses its power. This process isn't comfortable. It feels like standing naked in front of your own soul. You'll see parts of yourself you've ignored for years, the bitterness you carry, the fear that drives your ambition, the guilt you hide under productivity. You'll realize that some of the good parts of you, politeness, helpfulness, even kindness, are sometimes masks for insecurity or fear of rejection. But this realization isn't meant to shame you, it's meant to liberate you. Because only when you see your own darkness clearly can you stop being controlled by it. Jung said, "There is no coming to consciousness without pain." The act of self-destruction, of breaking down illusions, is painful but necessary. The old self doesn't die peacefully. It clings to you. It will try to bargain with you. Don't change too much, just fix a few things. It will tempt you with comfort, with distraction, with nostalgia for who you were. But comfort is the enemy of transformation. The old self must burn completely for the new one to emerge. This isn't just poetic language, it's psychological truth. Every time you refuse to face the truth about yourself, you keep the old self alive. Every time you confront it honestly, you chip away at its foundation. Imagine your identity as a house that's been built over the years. Some walls are strong, others are weak. Some rooms you've never entered. The foundation is cracked because it's been built on lies. I'm not good enough. I'll never change. I'm too broken. The first step toward rebirth is demolition. You tear down what's unstable. You stop pretending the structure is fine just because you've decorated it nicely. You take the hammer to your illusions, the comforting stories you tell yourself to avoid responsibility. That's what Nietzsche meant by overcoming. Not hating yourself, but facing the truth that who you currently are is just the beginning, not the final form. There's something sacred in destruction. Fire, after all, is both a destroyer and a purifier. When forests burn, the ground becomes fertile again. When metal melts, it can be reshaped. The same applies to the soul. The pain you feel when you face your flaws isn't punishment. It's the heat that melts away what's false. That's why philosophers and mystics alike have always described transformation in the language of fire, death, and rebirth. You can't bypass the burning stage. Start small, but start real. Don't make another list of goals. Make a list of illusions. Write down every lie you tell yourself to stay comfortable. Maybe you tell yourself you're too tired, too late, too unlucky. Maybe you've built your entire identity on what you've survived, not what you can create. Question it all, because truth destroys everything that cannot stand on its own. Once you do this, once you face the truth, something begins to shift. You stop being afraid of your flaws because you've looked them in the eye. You stop needing others to validate you because you're no longer hiding behind masks. You start to feel a strange kind of peace, even in the discomfort, because you know the destruction is making space for something new. And yes, it's scary. It feels like losing yourself. But what you're losing is the false version of you, the one who kept you small, the one who made decisions from fear, the one who settled for less because it was safe. That self has to die if you want to live freely. So when you feel the pain of this process, the confusion, the uncertainty, the loneliness, remember that this is not the end. It's the fire before creation. It's the breaking before rebuilding. It's the death before rebirth. Nietzsche wasn't asking you to destroy yourself for the sake of pain. He was asking you to destroy the illusions that keep you from your potential. Jung wasn't asking you to drown in your darkness. He was asking you to integrate it, to own it, to make it serve your wholeness. You can't heal what you won't face. You can't grow into who you're meant to be while defending who you've been. Real transformation starts when you stop polishing the surface and start dismantling the foundation. The process is ugly, but it's honest. And from that honesty, a new kind of strength emerges. One that isn't built on ego or illusion, but on truth. That strength is the beginning of rebirth. So let the old self resist. Let it fight, scream, and beg for survival, and then let it burn. Because every great transformation begins not with a step forward, but with the courage to step into the fire. After destruction, there is silence. When the old self burns away, what remains is not clarity, not peace, not immediate transformation, but emptiness. And that emptiness terrifies most people. We live in a world that worships noise and motion. If something isn't constantly happening, we think something's wrong. When we stop chasing, producing, or talking, we start to feel lost, restless, and uneasy. But that discomfort is not a sign of failure. It's the doorway to rebirth. Every new beginning starts in the void. Lao Tzu said, "To be reborn, become empty. To be full, become hollow." He understood that emptiness isn't the opposite of life, it's the womb of it. Before you can fill yourself with purpose, truth, and discipline, you must first become nothing, because only nothing can receive something new. The Buddhist concept of shunyata, often translated as emptiness or voidness, captures this perfectly. It doesn't mean despair or nihilism. It means understanding that everything is temporary, that nothing has a fixed or independent identity. The cup is useful not because of the clay that forms it, but because of the empty space inside. Without emptiness, there's no room for anything to enter. That's the mistake most people make after destruction. They rush to fill the void immediately. They destroy their bad habits only to replace them with new distractions. They leave a toxic relationship only to jump into another. They quit a job that made them miserable, but instantly look for another without understanding why they were unhappy in the first place. They can't bear the silence, so they fill it with something, anything, to avoid feeling it. But if you never allow yourself to sit in the emptiness, you'll never understand what's supposed to grow there. The void is uncomfortable because it exposes how much of our life was built on noise. We realize how addicted we are to stimulation, how rarely we let ourselves be alone with our own thoughts. We scroll endlessly, binge watch, text, talk, consume, not because we're entertained, but because silence confronts us with truth. And truth is heavy. It shows us how lonely we are, how uncertain we feel, how much we've been distracting ourselves from deeper pain. But it's in that stillness that the mind begins to settle, like mud sinking in water. And when the water becomes still, it starts to reflect clearly. That's what emptiness gives you, the ability to finally see yourself. Lao Tzu wrote that the highest virtue is like water. It flows, adapts, and fills the lowest places. Water doesn't fight for control, it yields, and in yielding, it shapes the world. Emptiness teaches you that same wisdom. When you stop clinging to control, when you stop trying to force every part of your life into a fixed meaning, you begin to see the natural rhythm of things. You realize that not every void is meant to be filled, not every silence needs to be broken. The ego hates that, because the ego thrives on definition. I am this, I do that, I have these things. But emptiness strips that away until all that's left is pure awareness. No titles, no roles, no masks. And from that awareness, rebirth becomes possible. The modern world does everything it can to keep you away from that state. Look around. Every silence is interrupted by a notification, every pause filled with a podcast, every idle moment replaced with a scroll. We've lost the ability to do nothing. But the mind cannot transform in chaos. It transforms in stillness. The great thinkers, artists, and spiritual masters throughout history all understood this. Buddha reached enlightenment under a tree, alone, in silence. Musashi refined his philosophy in solitude. Even Marcus Aurelius, surrounded by war and responsibility, wrote to himself at night, a silent conversation with his own soul. Stillness is where the mind resets, where the noise of the world fades and the voice of truth begins to whisper. To be reborn, you must first sit in the void. Not for an hour or a day, but as long as it takes for your mind to stop begging for distraction. At first, it will resist. You'll feel anxious, bored, maybe even lost. You'll want to check your phone, talk to someone, or find something to do. But if you sit through it, if you refuse to escape, something starts to shift. You begin to notice the patterns of your thoughts, the way your mind jumps from one craving to another. You realize how much energy you've spent running from yourself, and slowly, you begin to see that emptiness isn't an absence, it's a presence. It's the space where creation happens. Just like a blank page holds infinite potential before a word is written, the void within you holds infinite possibilities for who you could become. This is the sacred pause. The space between the destruction of the old and the creation of the new. In that space, don't rush. Don't fill it with forced positivity or instant reinvention. Let yourself decompose a little. Let go of needing to know who you are for a while. The mind, when given quiet, naturally begins to heal itself. Thoughts settle, emotions soften. The constant craving for validation begins to fade. You start to realize you're okay without constant input from the world. You begin to exist for yourself, not for an audience. That's when real selfhood begins to form. So how do you practice emptiness in a world that's allergic to it? Start by stripping away what's unnecessary. Look at your life with ruthless honesty, your routines, your possessions, your commitments. Ask yourself, does this add depth to my life or does it just fill space? Most people carry more than they need. Not just physically, but mentally. They hoard old memories, stale relationships, outdated ambitions. Let them go. Create space. The mind, like a room, needs to breathe. When it's cluttered, there's no room for new ideas, no clarity for growth. Next, embrace solitude. Not the kind that feels lonely, but the kind that's deliberate. Spend time alone without reaching for your phone, without music or background noise. Sit outside, take long walks, write, think, breathe. Solitude reconnects you with yourself, with your unfiltered thoughts and emotions. It's where authenticity begins. In the quiet, you'll start to realize how much of what you've been doing was just noise, empty movement without purpose. Finally, learn to exist without constant validation. Most people can't go a day without checking if the world approves of them. Likes, messages, replies, recognition. But the need for validation is the enemy of rebirth because it ties you to the identity you're trying to escape. Every time you crave approval, you strengthen the old self. The new self doesn't need applause to exist. It's content in its own presence. The next time you achieve something, resist the urge to announce it. Let it be yours alone. That silence is powerful. It builds internal validation, the kind that can't be taken away. Understand this. Emptiness is not loss. It's not failure. It's not a void to be feared. It's creation's waiting room. Think of it as the soil lying fallow after harvest, bare, quiet, but preparing for new life. The mind needs that same rest. Every great transformation begins with nothingness. Out of that nothing, the seeds of the new self begin to grow. Lao Tzu said, "We shape clay into a pot, but it is the emptiness inside that holds whatever we want." Your potential works the same way. It's the emptiness within you that gives space for your next form to take shape. So don't rush to fill your silence. Don't panic when life feels empty. Sit in it, breathe in it, because that's where the old you dissolves and the new you begins to form. Not in chaos, not in noise, but in the sacred, fertile stillness of the void. When the noise fades and you finally find yourself in that space of emptiness, a new challenge appears. What now? Emptiness is only the beginning. It's the clearing of the soil, not the planting. After you've destroyed what no longer serves you and stripped away all that's unnecessary, you face a question that echoes from deep inside. What is this all for? That question is the birth of meaning. And without meaning, no transformation can last. You can change your habits, your appearance, even your environment, but without a purpose to tie it all together, everything eventually collapses. Meaning is the skeleton of rebirth. It's what gives structure to the new self you're building. Viktor Frankl understood this better than almost anyone. He was a Jewish psychiatrist who lived through the horrors of the Nazi concentration camps. He lost everything. His family, his freedom, his home, every day was a confrontation with death. Yet somehow he endured. Not because he found comfort and not because he had control over his circumstances, but because he had a why. Frankl wrote, "He who has a why to live can bear almost any how." Those words weren't philosophy for him, they were survival. He realized that even in the most unbearable conditions, people could withstand immense suffering if their life had meaning. Those who gave up were often the ones who felt that their pain had no purpose. Those who held on had a reason, something beyond the immediate suffering, a person to live for, a project to finish, a belief to prove true. Meaning doesn't erase pain, but it gives pain a direction. It transforms chaos into purpose. Most people run from suffering, chasing comfort as if comfort is the same thing as happiness. But comfort doesn't fulfill the soul, it just numbs it. When you have no meaning, even an easy life feels empty. When you have meaning, even a difficult life feels full. That's the paradox Frankl revealed, the secret of the human spirit. We don't need a perfect life, we need a reason to keep going. Existentialist philosophy builds on this truth. Thinkers like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus argued that life itself doesn't hand us meaning, There's no built-in purpose, no universal reason we exist. At first, this sounds depressing, but it's actually liberating. Because if life doesn't give you meaning, that means you are free to create it. You are not a victim of fate or circumstance. You are the author of your purpose. That's what existentialists meant by freedom. You can't control everything that happens to you, but you can choose what it means. You can take the same event, loss, heartbreak, failure, and turn it into despair or growth. The event is neutral, meaning gives it shape. This is the moment when your rebirth becomes conscious. It's when you stop drifting through life waiting for someone or something to define you. Instead, you take responsibility for defining yourself. You stop asking, "What's the point?" and start saying, "I will give this a point." Meaning is not something you find in books, religions, or achievements. Those things can guide you, but they can't replace the inner decision to live for something. The process of rebirth demands that decision, because without it, you'll fall back into the same patterns of emptiness and distraction that destroyed your old self in the first place. So, how do you create meaning? You start by asking a question that most people avoid. What would make my suffering worthwhile? This isn't a pleasant question, but it's the only one that matters. Because suffering is inevitable. No matter what you do, there will be pain, loss, and struggle. The difference between a meaningful life and a meaningless one is whether that suffering serves a purpose. If you suffer for nothing, pain becomes torment. If you suffer for something greater than yourself, pain becomes sacred. That's what Frankl discovered in the camps. He couldn't choose whether to suffer, but he could choose why he suffered. Maybe for you, that why is to become the strongest version of yourself so you can lift others. Maybe it's to master a craft, raise a family, create something lasting, or understand the truth about life. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it pulls you beyond comfort. Comfort will never give you meaning. Comfort only feeds the body, purpose feeds the soul. A life built on comfort alone will always collapse under the weight of its own emptiness. Once you begin to see this, everything in your life starts to reorganize around that why. You start saying no to things that don't align with it. You stop chasing validation from people who don't share it. You wake up with a different kind of energy, not motivation, but direction. Motivation is emotional and temporary. Direction is spiritual and enduring. That's why meaning matters more than goals. Goals can fail. Purpose cannot. If your purpose is strong enough, even failure becomes part of it. This is the practical heart of this philosophy. You need to define your 2026 purpose, not a list of tasks or resolutions, but a mission statement for your existence this year. Something that answers, why am I here and what am I building? Write it down in one sentence. Keep it simple, but make it real. A vow to yourself. Something like, in 2026, I will live with courage, discipline, and depth. I will not waste my days on things that don't feed my soul. Or, this year I dedicate myself to becoming the kind of person my younger self needed. It doesn't have to sound grand or poetic, it just has to be true. That sentence becomes your compass. Every decision, every habit, every challenge, measure them against it. Once you have your mission, protect it. Life will constantly try to pull you away from it with distractions, temptations, and comfort. You'll be tested. But meaning isn't proven in moments of ease. It's proven in the moments you want to quit. The world doesn't hand you meaning. It asks you to prove that you deserve it. That's what Frankl saw in the camps. The people who survived were the ones who found meaning in spite of suffering, not after it ended. And remember this, meaning isn't always loud. It doesn't always look heroic or world-changing. Sometimes it's quiet. It's found in small acts done with intention. A father working long hours to provide for his children. A writer sitting alone, crafting words that might help one person see life differently. A person choosing kindness over bitterness, even when the world gives them every reason to harden. That's meaning too. Rebirth doesn't demand that you change the world. It demands that you change your relationship to it. When you live with meaning, everything becomes sacred. the ordinary transforms. Even your struggles take on beauty because they're part of your story. You stop feeling like a victim of life and start feeling like a participant in it. You're no longer waiting for life to make sense, you're giving it sense. That's the shift from mere survival to evolution. Without meaning, rebirth is just change. Surface level, fragile, temporary. But when your rebirth is fueled by meaning, it becomes transformation with direction. So, take the emptiness you've created and fill it wisely. Fill it not with noise or goals, but with purpose. Choose a why that's worth suffering for. Make it your anchor, because when life becomes heavy, and it will, that why will keep you standing. It will remind you that your pain is not meaningless, your struggles are not wasted, and your rebirth has a reason. Meaning doesn't erase the storms of life, but it gives you a reason to walk through them. It turns suffering into strength, emptiness into purpose, and existence into evolution. Viktor Frankl discovered that in a place where everything human was stripped away, the only freedom that remained was the freedom to choose one's attitude, to give meaning to life, no matter the conditions. That's the essence of rebirth. Not waiting for a perfect world, but finding your purpose inside an imperfect one. So as you move through this year, carry your why like a flame. Let it light your path through confusion and darkness. Because as long as that flame burns, you'll never be lost. And when the old self tries to drag you back into comfort, remember this. The soul doesn't crave an easy life. It craves a meaningful one. And meaning, once chosen, becomes the foundation of everything you're meant to build. Purpose without discipline is just a wish. You can know your why, you can have the most meaningful mission in the world. But if you can't master yourself, it all collapses. The Stoics understood this thousands of years ago. They believed that freedom is not something given to you by the world. It's something you earn through self-control. You can't call yourself free if your emotions control you, if your desires dictate your actions, or if every inconvenience breaks your peace. Real freedom begins within. It begins when you stop being ruled by impulse and start ruling yourself. Epictetus, one of the great Stoic philosophers, was born into slavery. He owned nothing, not even his own body. Yet even as a slave, he realized something profound. His mind was still his. The one thing no one could take from him was his ability to choose his response. He said, "No man is free who is not master of himself." Think about that. A man who was legally considered property, who had no external freedom, still saw himself as free because he refused to be enslaved internally. He had no control over his circumstances, but full control over his mind. And that, the Stoics believed, is the foundation of peace, not the absence of difficulty, but the mastery of response. Marcus Aurelius, on the other hand, was the most powerful man in the world, the emperor of Rome, and he said almost the same thing. You have power over your mind, not outside events. Realize this, and you will find strength. Imagine that contrast. One man in chains, one man on a throne, and both teaching the same truth. Freedom has nothing to do with status or comfort. It's not about wealth, success, or control over others. It's about control over yourself. Whether you're powerful or powerless, the question remains the same. Do you rule yourself, or are you ruled by your impulses? Self-mastery is the bridge between who you were and who you must become. You can destroy the old self and discover your purpose, but without discipline, the old patterns return. The mind is like a wild horse. If you don't learn to guide it, It will drag you back to where you started. And that's what happens to most people. They know what they want, but they can't stay consistent long enough to get it. They make promises, but they break them the moment life gets hard. Discipline isn't glamorous, but it's sacred. It's the daily choice to align your actions with your values, not your moods. The Stoics taught that the first step toward mastery is awareness. Awareness of what you can and cannot control. Most suffering comes from trying to control the uncontrollable. Other people, external events, outcomes. You can't control how the world behaves, but you can always control how you respond. This understanding frees you from chaos. Every time you catch yourself worrying about things outside your power, what people think, what might go wrong, what you can't fix, stop and ask, what can I control right now? Usually the answer is simple. Your attitude, your effort, your focus, your words. Everything else is noise. This is why the Stoics began each day with intention. They would remind themselves that life would test them, that people would be ungrateful, rude and selfish, that plans would fall apart, that fortune would change. But by preparing their minds in advance, they wouldn't be shocked or thrown off. Marcus Aurelius wrote in his journal, "When you wake up in the morning, tell yourself, today I will encounter people who are meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, deceitful, envious, and unsocial. All these things happen because they are ignorant of what is good and evil. But I have seen the beauty of good and the ugliness of evil, and I recognize the humanity we share." In other words, expect difficulty and choose calmness anyway. That's mastery. The Stoic path to self-mastery is simple, but it's not easy. It's built on small daily choices. You begin each day with intention. What can I control today? Not what you wish you could control. Not outcomes, not people, not the future, but what's right in front of you. You end each day with reflection. What mastered me today? Was it anger, laziness, pride? Did I act according to my principles, or did I act according to impulse? This daily rhythm, intention and reflection, slowly builds the habit of awareness. You begin to catch yourself before you react. You start noticing your emotional triggers and learning to pause before responding. And that pause is where freedom lives. Most people live like slaves to emotion. Anger says, shout, and they shout. Desire says, buy, and they buy. Fear says, run, and they run. But mastery is the ability to pause and decide consciously. It's not about suppressing emotion. It's about not being owned by it. Anger, fear, pleasure, they're all natural, but they shouldn't steer your life. The Stoics saw emotions not as enemies, but as signals, reminders of what we value or fear. When you learn to read those signals without being controlled by them, you gain true strength. Discipline also means controlling attention. In today's world, attention is constantly under attack by notifications, ads, entertainment, endless noise. The Stoics would see this as one of the greatest threats to mastery. You can't control your mind if you can't control your focus. Every moment spent in distraction weakens self-control. The modern version of Stoicism isn't about living like a monk. It's about reclaiming your attention from the digital chaos that wants to own it. Self-mastery begins the moment you choose where your attention goes. If you can focus fully on one thing, your breath, your work, your thoughts, even for a few minutes, you're training your mind to obey you. Stoicism also teaches us to practice restraint, not because pleasure is bad, but because dependence on it is. When you need comfort to function, you've already lost control. Seneca wrote that, "It is not the man who has too little, but the man who craves more who is poor." The Stoics practiced voluntary discomfort, sleeping on the floor, fasting, walking barefoot, not out of self-punishment, but to prove to themselves that they didn't need luxury to live well. They learned to be content with less, so they could never be enslaved by desire. You don't have to live like an ascetic, but you should regularly test yourself. Skip a comfort, delay gratification, sit with boredom. Each small act of restraint strengthens the will. Self-mastery is not about control for its own sake, it's about freedom. It's about living on your own terms. When you master yourself, no insult can shake you, no failure can destroy you, no temptation can corrupt you. You become calm in chaos, steady under pressure, unmoved by praise or blame. The world loses its power over you because your peace no longer depends on it. This is what Marcus Aurelius meant when he said, "You have power over your mind, not outside events." But self-mastery doesn't come all at once. It's a practice, a lifelong one. Every day offers opportunities to strengthen it. When someone offends you, that's a test of patience. When you feel lazy, that's a test of commitment. When things fall apart, that's a test of resilience. The Stoics didn't wait for perfect conditions to practice virtue. Every difficulty was training. They saw obstacles not as interruptions, but as the path itself. "The impediment to action advances action," wrote Marcus. "What stands in the way becomes the way." Every challenge is a chance to become more disciplined, more composed, more aware. So if you want to bridge the gap between who you were and who you must become, start with yourself. Before you try to master anything, your craft, your relationships, your ambitions, master your mind. You can't lead a new life if you're still following the commands of your old habits. Master your thoughts, your emotions, your reactions. Learn to respond, not react. Choose awareness over impulse and restraint over indulgence. The new self you're building, the one designed for 2026, won't be born out of excitement or motivation. It will be born out of quiet, consistent discipline. You'll know you're evolving when you no longer need to announce your goals, when you simply live them. When you stop being driven by moods and start being guided by principles. When you no longer chase control over others, but command control over yourself. And this is the essence of Stoicism, to live in accordance with reason, to align your actions with your values, and to find peace in what you can control. The old self seeks comfort. The new self seeks mastery. One is a slave to circumstance. The other is free in any condition. Each day this year, begin with that Stoic question. What can I control today? And end with its mirror. What mastered me today? Between those two reflections lies the entire practice of self-mastery. Over time, you'll start noticing the shift. Life won't get easier, but you'll become stronger. The noise of the world will remain, but it won't pull you off balance. You'll move through chaos with calm, through temptation with focus, through hardship with dignity. That's what rebirth through Stoicism looks like. Not a life without struggle, but a life where struggle no longer rules you. People love the idea of reinvention. They imagine waking up one morning completely different, confident, disciplined, unrecognizable from who they were before. It's a beautiful fantasy, but that's all it is. The truth is, no one changes overnight. Real transformation is not dramatic or cinematic. It's quiet, subtle, and often invisible while it's happening. The people who truly reinvent themselves don't do it through sudden bursts of motivation or grand decisions. They do it through small, consistent changes repeated every single day. The world only notices the final result, the success, the composure, the strength. But what creates that transformation is often boring. Small habits, small choices, small victories that add up over time. Aristotle said, "We are what we repeatedly do." Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. In other words, you don't become great by doing something once. You become great by doing it so often that it becomes who you are. The same principle applies to rebirth. You can't become a new person through a single decision. You must live the habits of that new person every day until they replace the old ones. People fail because they treat self-improvement like an event instead of a process. They expect the change to happen fast, and when it doesn't, they give up. But slow change isn't failure, it's nature. Everything real in life grows gradually. Muscles strengthen through repetition, not one workout. Wisdom grows through experience, not one realization. Identity shifts through consistency, not emotion. The Japanese philosophy of Kaizen captures this perfectly. The word itself means change for the better, but it carries a deeper meaning, the idea of continuous, incremental improvement. Kaizen teaches that massive progress is the result of small, steady refinements made over time. It was a philosophy that helped rebuild Japan's entire economy after World War II, not through sudden revolutions, but through small, daily improvements in efficiency, quality, and discipline. The same principle applies to individuals. You don't need to change everything at once, you just need to improve one thing, one small thing, consistently. That's the power of Kaizen. It replaces the pressure of perfection with the simplicity of progress. This is where most people fail, not because they lack potential, but because they underestimate small steps. We live in a culture addicted to extremes. People want 90-day transformations, 10x routines, or instant success. But radical change rarely lasts. It burns bright and then fades because it's not built on stable habits. The old self doesn't die through dramatic effort, it dies through quiet repetition. If you get 1% better each day, that may not sound like much, but over the course of a year, that compounds into massive change. 1% seems invisible at first, like a drop of water on stone, but over time, even drops can carve through rock. The philosophy of small change is also deeply humbling. It teaches patience, a rare virtue in the modern world. You have to learn to appreciate progress even when you can't see it. You might meditate for a week and feel no difference, write for a month and still hate every paragraph, or exercise for months before noticing any visible change. But transformation is happening beneath the surface. It's rewiring your mind, building momentum, reshaping your identity. Every small act of discipline reinforces the belief that you are capable of consistency, and that belief is what transforms you. Aristotle's insight into habit goes even deeper than people realize. He believed that moral excellence, virtue, isn't something you're born with. It's something you cultivate through practice. You become courageous by practicing courage. You become disciplined by practicing discipline. You become kind by practicing kindness. It's not about perfection. It's about repetition. If you want to be patient, you must act patiently even when you don't feel like it. If you want to be focused, you must practice focus even when your mind wanders. Change starts with action, not emotion. You don't wait to feel motivated. You act, and motivation follows. The practical path is simple but powerful. Adopt the 1% rule. Each day, improve one small aspect of your life. It could be something physical, doing one more push-up, eating one better meal, sleeping 15 minutes earlier. It could be mental, reading 2 pages, writing a few lines, thinking one better thought. It could be emotional, pausing before reacting, expressing gratitude, forgiving someone. The change doesn't have to be big, it just has to be consistent. Small wins create momentum. Momentum builds belief. Belief fuels identity. And once your identity shifts, effort becomes automatic. To make Kaizen real, track your habits. Write them down. There's power in seeing progress on paper. It turns something abstract into something measurable. Don't track results, track actions. Results fluctuate, but actions compound. You don't control whether you lose weight this week or gain followers this month, but you do control whether you exercise, create, or learn today. The Stoics would call this focusing on what's in your control, and Kaizen turns that principle into practice. Each tick on your list is proof that you're becoming someone new. The next step is to celebrate progress, not perfection. This might sound cliché, but it's vital. Most people destroy their own progress by being too hard on themselves. They expect flawless discipline, and the moment they slip, they give up entirely. But mastery isn't a straight line. It's a rhythm of progress and failure, forward steps and stumbles. What matters is that you keep returning to the path. The new self isn't built in a day. It's built in moments of recommitment. If you missed a day, start again the next. The only failure is quitting. Every other mistake is feedback. Kaizen also teaches that small change extends beyond habits. It transforms how you think. When you embrace small progress, you stop living in extremes. You stop saying things like, "I'll start tomorrow," or "I already failed, so what's the point?" Instead, you realize that every moment is a chance to improve, no matter how small. One deep breath can change your mood. 1 minute of focus can reset your mind. One act of kindness can shift your entire day. Small doesn't mean insignificant, it means sustainable. Big goals may inspire you, but small actions build you. There's also something spiritual about the philosophy of small change. It forces you to confront your ego. The ego wants recognition, applause, instant results, but Kaizen humbles the ego by teaching you to fall in love with process instead of outcome. You start to enjoy the simple act of improvement. Reading not to impress but to learn, exercising not to look good but to feel alive, working not for praise but for progress. When you focus on the process, you enter a state of flow. The journey becomes fulfilling on its own. That's when transformation becomes inevitable, when improvement stops being something you try to do and starts being something you are. Another aspect of small change that people overlook is identity. Your habits don't just reflect who you are, they create who you are. Every small action is a vote for the kind of person you're becoming. When you write even one sentence, you're voting for, "I am a writer." When you meditate for 5 minutes, you're voting for, "I am mindful." When you keep a promise to yourself, you're voting for, "I am disciplined." These votes accumulate. Over time, your identity shifts, not because of one grand act of willpower, but because of the hundreds of tiny moments where you chose growth over comfort. This is why rebirth can't be rushed. You can destroy the old self in a moment of realization, but building the new one takes time. Every habit you form, every small act of discipline, every decision to do the right thing when no one is watching, that's rebirth in motion. It's invisible, yes, but it's real. The world might not see it yet, but one day it will. The person you're becoming will quietly outgrow the person you were, and you'll look back realizing that the gap between them was built out of 1,000 small choices. So forget the idea of massive change. Forget the fantasy of waking up transformed. Focus instead on what you can do today, this hour, this moment. Improve by 1%. Take one step forward. Be slightly better than you were yesterday. It may not seem like much, but it's everything. Because if you keep doing that, the day will come when you'll look in the mirror and barely recognize who you've become. Not because of one big leap, but because of countless small ones. The philosophy of small change is the antidote to impatience. It's the path of quiet power, the path that turns intention into identity. Remember, rebirth is not a single act of transformation, it's 1,000 tiny acts of discipline. Each small choice matters. Each small moment counts. One day you'll realize that the small steps were never small at all. They were the entire journey. Every stage of transformation has its own landscape. Destruction is fire. Emptiness is the quiet aftermath. Discipline is the forge. Small change is the shaping of new form. But rebirth, true, deep rebirth, requires something most people run from: solitude. Every transformation needs a cocoon, a space of withdrawal where the noise of the world can no longer reach you, where your old identity loosens its grip, and where something new begins to take shape. It's not glamorous, it's not comfortable, but it's necessary. Without solitude, you remain an echo of others, reacting, conforming, and performing for a crowd that never really sees you. The cocoon is the space where you stop performing and start becoming. The Japanese swordsman Miyamoto Musashi understood this. After a lifetime of victory, more than 60 undefeated duels, he withdrew from society and lived alone in a cave. He called it Regando, the cave of spiritual awakening. There, he spent his final years meditating, reflecting, and writing the Book of Five Rings, one of the most profound works on mastery ever written. For Musashi, solitude was not loneliness, it was refinement. In the silence of isolation, he studied not just the sword, but himself. He realized that to conquer the world, he first had to conquer his own mind. That's why he wrote, "Fixation is the way to death, fluidity is the way to life." Solitude gave him that fluidity, the ability to detach from ego, to see life clearly, and to live deliberately. The Stoics shared the same understanding, even in the heart of ancient Rome, surrounded by chaos and politics. Seneca wrote that solitude is not an escape from the world, but a way to understand it more deeply. He didn't mean running away from responsibility or hiding from people. He meant creating inner distance, the ability to be alone within yourself, even while living among others. True happiness, Seneca wrote, is to enjoy the present without anxious dependence upon the future. That kind of presence only arises in solitude when the mind is no longer pulled by noise. It's where you stop reacting and start observing your thoughts, your desires, your emotions, and you begin to see what truly drives you. We live in an age where solitude has become a rebellion. Silence feels unnatural now. People can't even stand in line without reaching for their phones. Every empty moment has to be filled with scrolling music, notifications, conversations. The modern mind is addicted to noise because noise keeps it from seeing itself. It's easier to stay distracted than to face what's inside. But the old self, the one you're trying to outgrow, thrives on distraction. It feeds on it. Every scroll, every meaningless conversation, every moment of passive consumption reinforces that old identity. It keeps you numb, predictable, dependent. The new self cannot be born in that noise. It needs silence. Silence is not just the absence of sound, it's the presence of awareness. It's the space where truth begins to surface. When you sit in solitude long enough, without distraction, your thoughts start to settle like dust. At first, you'll feel restless. You'll think of everything you should be doing. Your brain will try to escape, anything to avoid facing yourself. But if you sit through that discomfort, something remarkable happens. Beneath all the noise, you'll start to hear a quieter voice, the one that belongs to you. The voice that's been drowned out by everyone else's opinions, expectations, and judgments. That voice is the compass of your rebirth. Musashi used solitude to sharpen his awareness until his mind became as precise as his sword. The Stoics used solitude to reflect and prepare for the world, not to escape it. Marcus Aurelius, even as emperor, wrote nightly meditations to himself, letters from his higher mind to his lower one. Those writings weren't meant for an audience, they were conversations between Marcus and his soul. That's what solitude is at its core. A conversation with your soul. And in that conversation, you begin to see what truly matters. You realize how little of what you chase is actually necessary. You start to separate what is essential from what is noise. To practice solitude in the modern world is to take your power back. It means no longer needing validation to exist. It means not measuring your worth by likes, messages, or the opinions of others. When you're alone, no one is there to clap for you, and that's the test. Can you still do what's right when no one's watching? Can you still stay disciplined, calm, and true without anyone's approval? That's where integrity is forged. Solitude is the training ground of integrity. It's easy to act virtuous in public. It's difficult to stay aligned in private. But your private life, the choices you make when the world isn't looking, shapes who you really are. So how do you reclaim solitude in a world that constantly pulls you away from it? You start by setting aside time each week to be fully alone. No distractions, no noise, no screen glowing in your hand, just you. Walk without headphones, sit in a quiet room, write, think, reflect. The goal isn't to do something, it's to be. The first few minutes might feel unbearable, like withdrawal, but over time, that silence becomes your refuge. It becomes a mirror that shows you what needs to change, and a compass that shows you where to go. In those moments, ask yourself the most honest question you can. Who am I when no one's watching? Not the person you perform as, not the identity you've built for approval, but the person beneath all that. How do you behave when there's no audience? What do you do when no one will ever find out? That's your real self. And if that version of you doesn't match the one you want to become, solitude gives you the space to reconcile them, to align your inner life with your outer one. The truth is, solitude reveals everything. It shows you your inner poverty and your inner strength. It exposes the emptiness of superficial goals and the richness of authentic ones. In solitude, you begin to see how much of your life has been shaped by fear. Fear of being misunderstood, of being alone, of being forgotten. But once you learn to sit in your own company and feel at peace, fear begins to dissolve. You no longer need to chase constant affirmation. You become grounded in yourself, and that grounding makes you unshakable. Seneca warned that people who can't bear to be alone are never truly free. If you can't stand your own company, it means you're not at peace with your own mind. Solitude isn't loneliness, it's self-friendship. Loneliness is when you feel empty in the absence of others. Solitude is when you feel whole in your own presence. They are opposites. And to walk the path of transformation, you must learn to turn loneliness into solitude, to transform the absence of others into the presence of yourself. Musashi once said, "It may seem difficult at first, but everything is difficult at first." Solitude feels difficult at first because it exposes everything we've been avoiding. But once you pass through that discomfort, it becomes your strength. It gives you independence of thought, clarity of mind, and emotional resilience. You stop being influenced by every passing trend or opinion. You stop needing constant noise to feel alive. Instead, you start to hear your own rhythm, your own pace, your own calling. That's when you truly begin to live by your own code. The old self fears solitude because it can't survive without distraction. It needs noise to stay alive. But the new self is born in silence. In that silence, you stop pretending. You stop running. You face yourself, your truth, your flaws, your beauty. You meet the person who's been waiting underneath all the noise, the real you. So give yourself that gift. Make solitude a ritual, not a punishment. Read, write, or think, but don't consume. Don't rush to fill the space. Let silence do its work. Let your thoughts rise and fall. Let emotions come and go without judgment. This is where confusion turns into clarity. The mind becomes still enough for wisdom to surface. You start seeing your problems for what they are, not as walls, but as lessons. You stop reacting and start understanding. Solitude isn't about leaving the world forever. It's about returning to it renewed. When you emerge from the cocoon, you're not detached. You're more present, more aware, more deliberate. You don't speak just to fill silence. You speak with purpose. You don't act just to move. You act with direction. You don't need validation anymore because you've found something stronger, self-respect. Every rebirth demands withdrawal, every metamorphosis requires a cocoon. Musashi withdrew to master himself, the Stoics withdrew to master their minds. You must do the same, not to escape the world, but to see it more clearly. Solitude is the sacred ground of transformation. It's where the noise ends and truth begins. It's where the old self dissolves and the new one quietly, powerfully takes its place. Rebirth is not a finish line you cross and celebrate. It's not the grand moment where everything finally falls into place and you declare yourself transformed. Rebirth is a cycle, a rhythm that continues for as long as you live. You don't become someone new once, you are always becoming. The self isn't something fixed or permanent, it's fluid, shifting and alive. You are constantly shedding old versions of yourself and growing into new ones, whether you realize it or not. The danger is when you forget this truth. When you think you've arrived, that you're done, changing, that who you are now is who you'll always be. That's when growth dies, and with it, your potential. Nietzsche urged, "Become who you are." It's one of the most misunderstood lines in philosophy because at first it sounds like a contradiction. How can you become what you already are? But Nietzsche's point was that your truest self isn't something you're born as. It's something you create. It's not a state to discover, but a process to embody. You don't find yourself like a lost object. You forge yourself through choice, struggle, and experience. Life is a continual process of refinement. The fire, the forge, and the hammer all shaping you at once. And the moment you think you've finished becoming, you've already started decaying. Heraclitus, centuries before Nietzsche, captured this same truth in his famous line, "No man ever steps in the same river twice." Because the river is always flowing, and the man is always changing. Everything in life is in motion. Nothing stays still. The cells in your body, the thoughts in your mind, the circumstances of your life, all of them are shifting from moment to moment, yet we cling to permanence. We want things to stay the same because change feels uncertain, but that's the illusion that causes suffering, the belief that stability is natural when, in reality, change is the only constant. When you resist change, you suffer. When you embrace it, you evolve. The Stoics saw this clearly. To them, life was a dance with impermanence. They didn't fight against change, they moved with it. Marcus Aurelius wrote, "Observe constantly that all things take place by change, and accustom yourself to the thought that the nature of the universe loves nothing so much as to change the things that are." In other words, life itself is built on transformation. The seasons turn, the body ages, the world shifts. The Stoic goal wasn't to control these changes, but to adapt gracefully to them. Wisdom, for them, wasn't the power to make life obey you. It was the strength to stay balanced while everything moved around you. Rebirth, then, is not perfection. It's progress. The goal isn't to become flawless. It's to remain in motion, to keep moving toward better, deeper, truer versions of yourself. Perfection is a trap because it freezes you. The moment you chase the illusion of perfect, you become static. You start fearing mistakes, avoiding risks, and resisting growth. But life is motion, and progress is messy. Becoming means failing, learning, adjusting, and continuing anyway. The Japanese concept of wabi-sabi, the beauty of imperfection, fits perfectly here. The cracks and flaws in your journey don't ruin it, they prove that you're alive and evolving. Think about it this way. Everything alive is in motion. Rivers flow, winds shift, trees grow and shed leaves. The moment something stops changing, it dies. You're no different. You'll go through cycles of rising and falling, clarity and confusion, strength and weakness. But each phase serves a purpose. The destruction you went through earlier wasn't the end. It was preparation. The emptiness you felt afterward wasn't punishment. It was space being made for growth. The discipline and small steps you took built momentum. The solitude gave you clarity. Now this final stage, becoming, is about learning to stay in that flow without clinging to any one version of yourself. The practical path begins with awareness. You have to accept that you are never a finished product. View life as an ongoing act of creation, like a sculptor who never stops chiseling, not because the statue is broken, but because it's alive. This means regularly reviewing and refining your goals and values. The things that mattered to you last year may not matter now. The person you wanted to be at 25 may not fit who you are at 30. People cling to outdated goals out of pride. They confuse consistency with authenticity. But true authenticity means allowing yourself to evolve. Growth requires the courage to change your direction when your soul demands it. Every few months, stop and ask yourself, what am I becoming right now? Not what am I doing or achieving, but becoming. Are your actions shaping you into someone you respect, or are they turning you into a stranger to yourself? This question keeps you awake, because it's easy to drift through life following routines without noticing how they're shaping you. Every choice you make is sculpting your character. The people you talk to, the content you consume, the habits you practice. Becoming isn't abstract, it's built moment by moment. The life you live today is the soil from which your future self grows. Another truth about becoming is that it's not linear. You'll have seasons of progress and seasons of stillness. There will be times when you feel unstoppable and times when you feel lost. Both are necessary. The Stoics would remind you that no phase is permanent. When you're struggling, don't despair. This too is part of the cycle. When you're thriving, don't grow complacent. This too will change. The key is to remain steady through the waves, to keep your internal compass aligned even when external winds shift. Nietzsche's idea of becoming also carries a deeper, almost spiritual challenge. He believed that life's purpose is to continuously surpass yourself, to keep breaking your limits, not for fame or success, but because the act of overcoming gives life meaning. Every time you face discomfort, every time you outgrow a fear or weakness, you fulfill that calling. The goal is not to become the best version of yourself, it's to never stop becoming better. The process is the point, the journey is the destination. Heraclitus would say that resisting change is like trying to dam a river with your hands. You might hold it for a moment, but eventually the current will break through. It's better to learn how to move with the current, to flow with life instead of against it. This doesn't mean passivity, it means adaptability. When circumstances shift, adapt. When opportunities arise, evolve. When setbacks hit, adjust your sails. This mindset turns chaos into possibility. You stop fearing change and start using it as a tool for growth. The Stoics would call this amor fati, the love of fate. It means not just accepting change, but embracing it as necessary and good. To love your fate is to trust that everything, even hardship, contributes to your becoming. Every challenge, every heartbreak, every failure refines you. The Stoics didn't see misfortune as punishment. They saw it as training. Life, in their eyes, was a school for the soul. And as long as you keep learning, you keep becoming. So, how do you live this way? Start by abandoning the illusion of arrival. Stop waiting for a point in the future when everything will finally make sense. Life doesn't suddenly become clear one day. Clarity grows slowly through reflection and action. Instead of asking, when will I get there? Ask, how can I move forward today? That shift in focus changes everything. It keeps you humble, patient, and alive to the present moment. Another practice is to view each day as a small cycle within the greater cycle of life. Each morning is a birth. Each night is a death. You wake, you act, you reflect, and you begin again. If you treat each day as its own rebirth, you'll never drift too far from the path. The Stoics practiced this through daily journaling, reflecting on the day's choices, learning from mistakes, and preparing for the next sunrise. This constant review keeps the process of becoming conscious. It reminds you that transformation isn't something that happens in grand gestures, but in the ordinary rhythm of living deliberately. Ultimately, becoming means learning to live lightly, not clinging to any identity so tightly that it suffocates you. You are not a fixed story. You are a draft that's constantly being rewritten. That's not something to fear, it's something to celebrate. Because as long as you're still becoming, you're still alive, still growing, still capable of wonder. So remember, rebirth is not a single moment. It's an ongoing act. You're not meant to reach some perfect version of yourself and stop there. You're meant to evolve endlessly, to keep learning, unlearning, and recreating who you are. The new you isn't an arrival, it's a direction, a path you walk for the rest of your life. And as you walk it, you'll realize something beautiful. There's no final version of you, because you were never meant to end. You were meant to become